sources. As we've done that, we've found that information security is extremely important. The public trust that we have largely depends upon how well we perform and how well we protect the public's information. So there's a key emphasis on that that we haven't seen 20 years ago. And interestingly enough, many of our agencies are doing business processes and doing essentially the same thing that they've been doing for a long while, but now we've got a renewed emphasis, or maybe in some cases a brand new emphasis, on how we protect the public's information, how we protect the integrity of that information, and trust that, and we safeguard that and provide stewardship of that information. So there's been a lot of work done in the last 2 years, and we are going to share that information with you. In 2005, the Oregon legislature passed a bill that's been codified in ORS 182 that set out some activities around data security and information security, some responsibilities under DAS. So Teresa today is going to go through kind of a report card of the progress we're making and implementing those activities and what we've been doing and how we're going forward in that. In addition, we have defined information security more broadly than just data security. Because to the citizen of Oregon, it doesn't matter if we have a breach, if it's a data breach, or if we lose their information on a piece of paper. It's information, and we have an obligation to manage that and safeguard it in a very responsible way. So we take our charge beyond just data security, but all information security and how we manage and safeguard information. So Teresa today will talk a little bit about that. She'll give you an overview of what we're doing in the area of policies. We've had an extensive set of policies that we've established in the last 2 years, actually the last 18 months. Planning, our strategic planning around security and our security plan, where we're at, progress we're making on that. She'll talk to you about training, about what we're doing in training to help agencies become aware of what they should be doing in this area and using these training modules as a way of helping them throughout their organization train staff so they have an awareness of everything that they do that could impact information security. And then finally, we'll share with you how we are assessing our across the agency enterprise our maturity and our effectiveness in safeguarding information. We looked at it in 13 domains of the International Standards Organization around security, and we want to look at how each agency is doing in this area, and we track it and assess that. And really, our effectiveness as an organization is measured by that cumulative score. So Teresa will go over that as well. We've got about 20 minutes. We will go through that very quickly. We're just really going to be able to hit the highlights, but we would welcome any of the members to follow up with questions a day or later, and we'd be happy to take more time at a later date to go through in more detail in any one of these areas. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Teresa Massey.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Massey. I'm the State Chief Information Security Officer. Thank you for the opportunity to give you an update on what we've been doing in the Enterprise Security Office and our partnership with the agencies to help reduce risk exposure throughout the state. You have a presentation in front of you, so we're looking at page 3 right now. As Dugan mentioned, we wanted to give you an update on our progress as far as ORS 182.122, which focuses on security. It's not completely comprehensive, but it does hit on a number of areas, and we wanted you to be aware of what we've been doing. As Dugan mentioned, that particular law calls on us to outline policy standards, procedures, et cetera, in the area of information security. And I'm going to talk about some of these items a little bit later, but I did want to mention that we've developed or in the progress of developing a overall security plan for the state. And then underneath that, there are various components, what the Enterprise Security Office is going to be doing, the responsibilities of the agencies as far as that's concerned, and also, of course, the state data center. Dugan mentioned that we have developed and provided the agencies with about six enterprise security policies, which they're working on. Most of those came out late last year, so I'll give you a little more idea of what some of those are. For the Enterprise Security Office, we developed a strategic plan which specifically outlines what we're going to be doing within our area of the Enterprise Security Office. As part of the overall plan, as I mentioned, the agencies need to develop plans for their particular organizations to focus on the risks that they have within their particular agencies and to develop plans so that they have a path and a direction on how they're going to be reducing risk within their organizations. And then we're also, as part of our strategic plan, going to be developing an enterprise security architecture, which will map to the overall enterprise architecture. On page four, part of the ORS also outlines that we're to review and verify security of information systems and conduct vulnerability assessments. Again, I'll talk about this a little bit later. We have a master contract in place for the agencies to utilize to conduct risk assessments within their own organization. We also use that within the Enterprise Security Office. We have done an information security business risk assessment. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And there have been reviews of specific security, either issues or applications within the agencies. And we follow up with agencies if they have any kind of issues or vulnerabilities within the organization to provide some consulting and to help them work through and make sure that they are remediating any of these areas. The data center, as I mentioned, also has an important role to play in the area of reducing risk exposure. They're responsible for the operational function of IT security within the data center. They monitor the network on a 24-hour basis. Most of the, or at least about 80% or 85% of the state's computing operations are housed within that organization, and so they have a big role to play in advising us if there's been any kind of vulnerabilities that they've identified so that we're aware of them from the state incident response perspective and also working with the agencies to help remediate those in a timely manner. On page five, as we mentioned before, we have policies. The incident response policy is in final review. With all of our policies, we take a very collaborative approach. We work with the agencies very closely so they have an opportunity to have input, and they have a level of comfort and ownership because at the end of the day, these enterprise policies provide direction for them. But each of the agencies take the enterprise policy and adapt that for their particular organization and their environment. The agency incident response plan is part of the overall policy that we're asking the agencies to have. So in addition to the security plan that we want them to develop, the incident response plan is a component of that. So we provide them with tools and templates. We plan to have some workshops to help them go through that so that there's some standardization and consistency across the agencies and so that they don't feel that they're out there with a blank page. You know, we're there to help them and to work through this. Responding to events, we've established a state incident response team. That's the responsibility for that falls within the Enterprise Security Office, and we act as the coordinators and facilitators of that that team. And we bring people on board according to what the incident is. You know, it might be an agency, it might be the state data center. It just depends on what the circumstances are. So we respond to incidents through the CERT. At the request of an agency, we often get phone calls and say, we're seeing something, we're not really sure what it is, can you come in and help us? So the team would be activated in that particular circumstance, or we may hear something from the state data center and work with them in tandem with the agencies to try to address and mitigate any of those. We have an enterprise incident response plan that we've developed. As I mentioned, we have some tools and templates for the agencies. And we're also working on developing a qualified vendor list so that in the if we were to have a major breach that was beyond the capacity of my staff to be able to handle, we have some external resources that would be able to come in and quickly help us to mitigate any issues that we might see so that they didn't spread to other agencies. So we're trying to have a very comprehensive package so that we can respond appropriately depending on what the particular incident might be. On page 6, alert appropriate parties. We have a very extensive mailing list, as does the State Data Center, so we try to keep agencies up to date when we see anything that we want them to be aware of, we want them to take action with. We prioritize the various patch alerts, et cetera, that come out from the various vendors so that they have an understanding of how quickly they need to react. So we really try to keep them up to date on expectations for them to move forward as quickly as possible. Forensic techniques are also part of this particular ORS. We've established a forensics lab. Now, this focuses on information security specifically, but the Enterprise Security Office has established a lab that's pretty sophisticated so that we're able to help the agencies as quickly as possible when they're running into any difficulties. My staff has been trained, and we're also trying to provide some training for agencies if they have resources available to help them be able to respond immediately. And then if they need some additional assistance, my staff is able to also provide them with that. And what we're going to be doing when this new policy comes out, the Enterprise Policy on Incident Response, is we're going to ask agencies, part of that policy is for them to advise us when they have an incident. They may or may not need our help, but we want to be aware of what's going on so that we can track and trend that over time, see areas where the agencies seem to be struggling, and maybe there's some policies or additional help that we can put into place for them. And finally, on incident response remedial action, as I mentioned, we work with the agencies very closely. We provide recommendations when we go through some kind of a forensics investigation with them, help them to understand what has happened, and help them through the remediation process and mitigation process, so hopefully it doesn't happen again. So that's kind of the coverage on the area of the ORS and what we've been doing. We wanted to chat with you a little bit about some of the other things that we're doing that are not specifically related. Some of them are to the ORS, but we're doing some additional activities in the area of information security. First of all, in the area of governance, I mentioned planning before. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Policy development and implementation, awareness and training, assessments that we need to do, consultation that we provide for the agencies, identity and access management, and finally the outreach and education. On governance, and I'm on page 9, the DAS director has established the Enterprise Information Security Advisory Board. It's made up of a number of agency directors, and we present to them various issues or policies, et cetera. They review everything that we do, our strategic plan, our security plan. They provide that vetting and give us executive feedback from the agency director level on what they need to, what they want to see, what would be helpful to them. They provide very good recommendations and suggestions for us, and they make final recommendations to the DAS director when they want to have something approved. So that board has been extremely valuable. They've been in place for about a year and a half now. We've had excellent participation, so we really appreciate the guidance and recommendation that we get from that group. We also have an Information Security Council, which is made up of information security officers from the various agencies as well as business representatives, because we believe that information security is not just about IT security. It's really a business issue. It's about acceptable risk. And that Security Council has been extremely effective. We have really great attendance. A wide variety of the agencies are participating in that. They make recommendations on the types of policies that they think would be effective. They help to draft the policies. So they are really the catalyst and form the foundation for us as we move forward in the types of areas that we need to focus on and the issues that they want the Enterprise Security Office to help them with on a statewide basis. Policy development, as I mentioned, is very collaborative. We work very, very closely with a number of organizations, certainly our advisory board, the Information Security Council, the Chief Information Officer Council, the Administrative Business Services Directors. We really try to reach out to a very, very broad audience and have them have a sense of ownership and understanding about the importance of information security within their organizations and let them know that we're there and that we really want to help them and that everybody has a role and responsibility to reduce risk exposure across all of the state agencies. On page 10, as I mentioned, we're developing the state information security plan. And within that, what we're really trying to do is talk about the International Standards Organization security domains that Dugan mentioned a little bit earlier, which is what all of our various policies and plans are based on. But within that, we also identify what the roles and responsibilities are, as I said, of the various entities that have crucial roles to play, the Enterprise Security Office, what we expect of the State Data Center, and of course, at the end of the day, where it really happens is within each of the agencies. Everything that we have within that plan maps to the ORS 182 to make sure that we've covered everything, all the responsibilities and direction that we have from that particular law, as well as, I said, the International Standards Organization 27002. The agencies, as part of one of our policies, are required to develop a security plan. As I mentioned, we've developed some tools and templates for them, and we're also having some security workshops where we actually sit down. It's primarily for the small and medium-sized agencies that don't have the same type of resources as some of the larger organizations. So we get together with them. We go through the tools and templates. They have an opportunity to network together, and as I said, so they don't feel like they're going through this process alone, and we have that standardization and consistency that we need across the organization. On page 11, the Enterprise Information Security Strategic Plan, this has gone forward to the Enterprise Information Security Advisory Board. They've had a look at that. We're continuing to make some refinements to that. We have a number of goals and objectives within that specifically defined about over the next 5 years what the Enterprise Security Office is going to be focused on. Again, this was developed collaboratively with the agency, so they had input into what we were going to be doing. And then, as I mentioned before, the Enterprise Information Security Architecture, which, again, is a component of the overall enterprise security architecture. We're working on that. Part of that, of course, involves what the agencies are doing and also what the State Data Center is doing. On page 12, policy development, we've outlined here the six policies that have been put into place, again, collaboratively with the agencies. Probably the most challenging policy that the agencies have is on the information asset classification policy. We had a community of practice on that where a number of agencies came together, talked about some of the issues that they saw, what we could do at the enterprise level to help them work through this. And so we recognize that this is a challenge to look through the information. There are four levels of classification within that particular policy. The fourth one is the highest level, which is the most confidential information that an agency has, and it goes down from there. And the policy has staggered implementation dates. We want, of course, the agencies to focus on the most confidential information that they have within their organization, make sure that they've identified it, that they know where it is, and that they can ensure that it's been appropriately protected. So, again, we're trying to be empathetic with the fact that there's a number of policies that they need to put into place. We recognize they can't do everything at one time, and we want to add as much value and as much help as we can at the enterprise level to help them work through these. But they clearly understand that all of these are important. Certainly, these are not all of the policies that we're going to have, but these were foundational policies that we felt needed to be in place within the agencies to, again, lower our area of risk statewide. And as I mentioned before, we have some pending policies that would be on the incident response policy, and then we're also looking at UIDA. There is a draft policy in place right now for UIDA, but we want to finalize that policy and make sure that the agencies have an opportunity to have some input. Senator. UIDA is the Uniform Electronic Transmission Act that was passed a couple of years ago by the state. As I said, there's a draft policy out there right now that agencies can refer to provide direction, but we want to revisit that with the agencies again. Things have changed over the last couple of years and make sure that the policy is reflective of the needs and requirements that the agencies have. So that'll be coming out. Sorry, Duke. Okay. I won't go through. On page 13, I've talked a little bit about some of the things we're doing as far as helping agencies. We've got forms, et cetera, templates, et cetera, that we're working with. And we want to, we're going to be surveying the agencies on an ongoing basis to see where they are in the process of their implementation. If any of them are struggling, what can we do at the enterprise level to help them through if it's a resource issue or they're simply not understanding what the requirements of the policy are. Awareness and training, we're pretty excited about this. This is really for information security, really a baseline for folks to understand at the user level what is their role and responsibility, how can they help to ensure a level of security across their organization. And everybody has a role in information security. So we've developed a number of training modules. These are computer-based training modules that are available for the agencies. Again, we developed these in a collaborative form. We had a work group and that we worked through what were the types of things that they wanted to see. These are very much focused at end users, so they're pretty baseline types of information, but just sometimes some good reminders of things, because sometimes we become a little too casual within the workplace and we forget that there are security risks. So these computer-based modules are available for the agencies to use so that they don't have to start with a blank page. And what we did was we have a snapshot. We didn't have the opportunity to show you today what some of the modules look like. They're interactive, and for folks that have a learning management system, they're able to track that who's taken these within their organization to make sure that everybody has gone through them. They consist of, on page 15, there's kind of an introduction to whatever the particular module might focus on, a little bit of an overview of it. On page 16, some further information where it breaks down whatever the module is targeted at. This particular slide shows availability. What does that mean from an information security perspective? Then on page 17, there is a quiz at the end of each of the modules. So there's a couple of questions that we ask people to try to get a sense of whether they've understood the information that has gone before. So they click off on one of these, and then hopefully they have the right answer. But even if they don't, it does tell them what the correct answer is. So they need to get a 70% correction rating on the modules to pass it. But again, we feel that these are pretty baseline training that we hope that all of the agencies are going to be able to utilize within their organization. As I said, it's part of one of the policies to ensure that folks have awareness training. On page 19, there's a number of other things that we're trying to do at the enterprise security level. We have information security alerts and bulletins that go out on a regular basis. We have a security tips newsletter that's provided to all of the agencies, as well as to the counties and cities that they're able to use. We do a trends report, which is really looking at various surveys that have been done on a national level, some of the issues that are on the horizon, so that agencies can have a heads up, some of the things they need to look at. We have a website that has both an internal and an external focus. We believe, because we're state government, we want to provide information on information security to our citizens so that they can be safe at home in the computing, et cetera, that they do to keep their confidential information safe. We also sponsor a number of security training for state agencies, and we also invite the counties and cities and our colleagues in education. We've had several of these, which they tend to be week-long sessions. SANS is an internationally recognized organization providing security. What we're really pleased about is we've worked out a deal with SANS. Normally their courses are about $3,600, and we are able to get those for one-third of the price. So we're trying to provide cost-effective, quality training to the agencies so that they can help, again, to reduce risk within their organization. So we're doing everything that we can at that level. On page 20, I'm talking about assessments. Last year, we did our first annual information security business risk assessment, and the focus here was truly on business risk. We identified about 13 agencies representing large, medium, and small organizations, and variety of agencies, you know, within the healthcare area, corrections area, et cetera. And we wanted to get a sense of where agencies were at from a business risk perspective. So we weren't focusing on technology, but we wanted to know the areas that business executives were worried about. What are the areas that they wanted to focus on, and how did they think their particular organization was doing? So we met with them. We used an external vendor to go through this exercise, which is also part of ORS 182, that we use a third-party organization so that we get that objective perspective on what we're doing. We established our performance measures based on information security business risk assessment. As I mentioned before, we have a master contract in place for information security risk assessments that we use and that the agencies can use. It helps them if they have something to go through it in a they have somebody available that's familiar with state government. Agencies also have done some of their own assessments on some of the new applications that they have to make sure that any security loopholes have been found and that they have quality products that they're putting out. And what's pending is we're going to be looking at doing an information security business risk self-assessment package for agencies, because we want all agencies to have an opportunity to participate. As I mentioned in the information security business risk assessment, we've identified 13 that we're working with, but we want everybody to be involved and have an understanding of where they are from an information security perspective and what are the areas that they need to be working on. We're also, as far as information, the risk assessment, we have one agency, Judicial, was part of our part of the assessment last year. They chose not to continue because they're working on their e-courts and felt that they needed to be focused on that. So we have 12 agencies, and we're also having two new agencies participating, so that over time, more than just the basic 12 have an opportunity to go through this exercise. On the next page, the performance measures. This will give you an idea. This is really an aggregate of the results of the 13 agencies from last year. So you can see on this where the lowest ranking was. Again, these are the 11 domains of the International Standards Organization 27002 domains, which focus on information security, where the average is, and then where the high points are. So what we found out is that basically, as we're working with our vendor, they had a model that was focused on COBIT, not on ISO. COBIT's often used in the area of auditing. But generally, most organizations were between 2.0 and 2.5. Some of the areas, such as financial organizations, tended to be a bit higher. They have, of course, a lot of state and federal laws that they need to be in compliance with, so one would expect that they would rate a little higher. What we're using for this, as I said, is ISO as the baseline, but also the Carnegie Mellon capability maturity model, which, as you can see on the left-hand side, that's that scale from 0 to 5, and the key is below as to what those various numbers stand for. So this is a nationally recognized measuring that we're using, so that it's very standard. We're using it on an ongoing basis. And the idea is to work with the agencies, and we understand that not everybody is going to get to a 4 or a 5. That can be an extremely expensive undertaking. It may take a lot of resources to maintain that. And depending on what the risk is, it may not be appropriate. So we want to understand what makes sense for the agencies. Maybe depending on a particular domain and the type of work that agency does, maybe they only need to be at a 2 or a 2.5. Maybe some other organizations need to be a little bit higher on the scale. So we want to be logical and reasonable about this and recognize that we don't have unlimited funds, but we do care about information security. So what can we do, and where does it make sense? So we're going to be using this on an ongoing basis, and we should have the results of this year's assessment available later on. Each of the agencies receives their own report on what their assessment is, and then we do an aggregate report which shows across all of the agencies where the state is based on their particular results. Okay, on 22, it just talks about some of the consulting that we provide to the agencies, and then on page 23, outreach and education, how we're working. We have a website, et cetera, and that we're working with also external organizations so that we keep up to date and make sure that we have a good program based on what other folks are doing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Teresa, you said back on the performance measurement chart, you said we need to be realistic and not every agency is going to be at a 4 or 5 or necessarily needs to be at a 4 or 5.
Right.
Do we have agencies that need to be at a 4 or 5 that aren't at a 4 or 5?
Yes, and this was the first, you know, as you can tell by the graph there, this was the first year that we actually went through the exercise, and what we did was we actually met with the agencies that are participating about 6 months prior to doing the final review just to make sure it was on their radar screen and that they were making progress, and I'm pleased to say that all of them are. And so we'll see that result in the next review that comes out. But certainly there are some organizations in some of those domains, not all of the domains, do they need to be at a 4 or 5. Again, it depends on the type of business that particular agency is in. So we want to work with them and understand what does being at a 4 or 5 mean? Is that even achievable for that organization? So, and what's the real risk that's involved? So we're trying to be, you know, very thoughtful about that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I think some of the, if you look at the performance measures, some of the agencies that are up towards the top that we've measured are probably pretty close to where they need to be. The agencies that were lagging at the bottom, we know they need to come up. There'll probably be very few agencies and maybe in a few domains that actually need to be at a 5. But for us, this gives us a way of kind of measuring the effectiveness of our overall program and how well we're doing in this. So we believe that these 13 domains that are being reviewed in this, pretty good reflection of how of the information security risks that would be in an agency. And we have, as one of our key performance measures for our program, really the cumulative score. So it really ties these outcomes to our outcomes, and it ties our performance to how well the agencies are doing. And I think they have to be connected. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the members if they have any further questions to take them offline because I want to move along. So thank you very
much.
Next, I'm going to ask Lindsay Ball to come up and give us a short report on Owen.
Chair, excuse me, Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm assigned to the governor's staff and subsequently to the Owen Project. Thanks for the opportunity to be before you today to give you an update on the progress of the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network project. Today I'll give you a brief history of what has taken place since 2002 with Owen, some of the early goals and FCC mandate, the system requirements, current Oregon wireless communication status, what has occurred in the 07, 08 legislative assemblies, and spectrum studies, and a plan overview. To kind of bring us back to a time and place shortly after 2001, the interest in interoperability as a result of 9/11 kind of peaked across the nation, and Oregon was no different. We started asking ourselves, what kind of condition is our public safety communication system in? Are we interoperable? Would we face the same disaster with communications that New York experienced during 9/11? What occurred out of that was everyone started to recognize that the system, communication system in Oregon for public safety was based on 1945 technology. It was not interoperable. It was analog-based, not digital, and was not capable of transferring data. Much of what we do today with cell phones on a routine basis personally was not afforded to our public safety servants and the public in Oregon. In 2005, the cornerstone in a kind of a breaking point in progress was the legislature passed House Bill 2101 that directed the four state agencies, Department of Transportation, Corrections, State Police, and Forestry, that have statewide communication systems be consolidated into one, and that there be a level of interoperability created between federal, state, local, and tribal governments. In 2006, there was a coverage analysis completed for the state of Oregon. There was a recommendation to fund OWEN. Radio tower usability assessment was completed. And probably the most striking discovery out of that 2006 evaluation was 80% of the towers and buildings associated with public safety communication in Oregon needed to be replaced. It did not meet the standards set forth by the Federal Communications Commission or the industry. During the 2007 legislature, we presented to the legislature a cost estimate of $665 million for replacement of the system and update it to digital microwave, P25 trunk digital radio system, which is the recommended communication system of the day. Legislature also told us two things after they looked at the $665 million, reduce the cost, and to also look at partnerships. And there was a legislative work group assigned. Now, there are a couple of things I want to emphasize with this. I am very strongly supportive of partnerships, particularly in this project. We have currently 35 partners that are signed, that have signed with OWEN in a partnership agreement to share sites around Oregon in the western 18 counties. And that has generated a cost savings to the state of $44 million, as estimated. It is also saving the local government's money as well, because they can build out a system sharing their resources with the state instead of independently having to fund a radio site independent of one another. So there's a savings to the local government as well, and it's an efficiency. We've also allowed private enterprise to have an opportunity to share the similar sites that we're occupying in Western Oregon. And we've had some very positive response from private vendors as well. The second thing I want to stress out of the 2007 legislature was a legislative work group was assigned. And I think that's been invaluable.
That's something before going further.
Yes.
Twice you've mentioned Western Oregon, and so I'm not sure why, what's happening with Eastern Oregon. There's no partnerships taking place there. We're not working with them to save money. Why are you distinguishing between Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon?
Chair Riley. Chair Riley, Representative Richardson. What we did in the planning of the build-out for the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network is that we have four phases of implementation. The first phase that was authorized by our legislature was phase one, which is the western 18 counties of Oregon. And that specifically was to build towers, buildings, and install digital microwave backbone. And that plan has been laid out in conjunction with the local governments and federal government as well, to maximize our resources. Now, phase two will be the installation of radios in the western 18 counties of Oregon, and also build the infrastructure of buildings, towers, and microwave in the north half of eastern Oregon. Phase three would be to install radios in the northern half of eastern Oregon and build infrastructure in the southern half of eastern Oregon. And then phase four is the final installation of radios in the southern half of eastern Oregon. That way, in conjunction with the partnerships, currently we focused on the western 18 counties because that's been the thrust of phase one. It's not to say we're not interested in the other counties And quite frankly, we've been approached by other counties wanting to participate, and in Eastern Oregon, it's just beyond our scope. We're going to get there, and we need to get there. But what's encouraging is people from other areas have seen the value of the partnerships and the cost-sharing venture as being very appropriate for the state and local government. Now, to get back to the legislative work group that I mentioned, and I stressed as it being very important to us, it gives us a monthly or bi-monthly opportunity to sit down with our legislators to go over the progress, also get feedback from the work group as to what they're hearing, their thoughts, their direction, and I can't stress how important that is for us working with such a large, complex project as what Owen is. It's extremely important, and I hope that people that are on that committee value that as much as I do, and I'm sure they do. That work group coupled with the partnerships, I think, are the two cornerstones of this project being successful.
And I might just mention that as soon as we come back into session and people are in town, that work group is going to be sharing what we've learned with the full legislature. So.
In 2008, an infrastructure design with concept was completed. We signed a Southwest 7 agreement with the Southwest 7 counties. The legislature directed Olin to move forward with Phase 1. We received community-oriented policing grants to build out a digital microwave system from the Dalles to Bend to Salem to Portland. The IWIN project, which is a link from Portland to, all the way to Medford, was completed for the Olympic trials, summer tryouts in Eugene area. We also conducted what was referred to as the 700 megahertz study, VHF comparison, and the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission radio link from Portland to Pendleton was completed. Now, there's a couple of firsts here that I want to share with you that I think is very notable. The 700 megahertz VHF comparison. When we received the cost estimate of $665 million, it was a hybrid system of 700 megahertz and VHF frequencies. And to explain what the difference is, the Federal Communications Commission released the 700 megahertz for public safety utilization, specifically for public safety. The VHF has been used for years. It's a very reliable source, frequency, and a source for communication. However, it's become crowded. There is interference on the frequency band, and it's becoming more limited in its use. 700 also is more data capable than much of the VHF frequencies. So in other words, with 700, we can send... It's easier for us to send pictures of suspects, driver's license checks, warrants checks, fire maps, that sort of thing over the 700 megahertz frequency. And it does penetrate buildings where some of the VHF will not. In conjunction with that, there was a cost associated with going 700, as assumed by the communication industries. But what we had been hearing, our partner state with information in Colorado, who had already gone to 700, was explaining to us that their experience with 700 was that it was almost covering the same real estate that VHF had been, and they had dropped their VHF and gone to 700. But the information that they had was anecdotal. I asked if there was a study had been done comparing VHF with 700, and there had not been. So the state of Oregon engaged in a study, And the industry recommendation was that if you're going to 700, you would need to build 30% more infrastructure than you had with VHF, making it very, very expensive. Now, to give you an idea, if you establish a site with a radio tower building power to it, that's about $500,000 to $600,000 a shot. So if you have to build 30% more of an infrastructure to accommodate 700, the cost is going to go way up. But then again, when I asked about the study, there had never been a comparison study done between VHF and 700, so we did one. No one else has done it. We took it upon ourselves to invest the money, because if we're looking at spending millions of dollars in the state of Oregon, I looked at a $300,000 research project as being very cost effective. The results that we got from that test shocked the industry people. It was an eye-opener for us as well. We discovered that the 700 megahertz performs almost equally as well as the VHF. A 3-5% difference, with the propagation of the 700 megahertz being 3-5% less than VHF. We felt also that with some adjustment to the antennas and some of the tuning, we could probably erase that 3-5% difference. So we have a 700 megahertz frequency that performs as well as VHF. We can reduce our costs. We can reduce the cost estimate from the results of our study, and the industry is now taking a hard look at the results of our study, and they are actually changing some of their evaluations and recommendations to other states and counties that want to go to 700 as a result of our efforts. We've saved ourselves a lot of money. Otherwise, we would have been on the hook for a 30% build-out cost that we wouldn't have had to incur. That's a first. No one else has done that. Some of the early goals, as I've mentioned earlier, is combining the four state aging state-owned systems. Include access to local public agencies to maximize interoperability. And I think this is an important point, because one of the things we've learned is I've talked to other states who have been putting in radio systems. They're putting in radio systems, but they're not necessarily going interoperable at the same time. Now, one of the things that the legislature directed the state of Oregon to do in 2005 was build a system, consolidate, and be interoperable. Now, it's a little bit more of a chore, but I still think that's a very wise move on behalf of the state, because if we do this once, let's do it once and be done with it and have interoperability at the same time. So I think Oregon's probably a little bit ahead of some of the other states that are building a system but not creating the interoperability to the level that we are. In addition to that, those states that are putting in systems and are reaching towards interoperability, they're not engaging a large metropolitan area, and we are embracing the Tri-County area as well as around the city of Portland, as well as Clark County in Washington, to be interoperable with that large metropolitan area, which is, from our evaluation, a first in the nation as well. And once again, maximize partnerships and collaboration at all levels of government. We also have another mandate that's placed upon us through the Federal Communications Commission. Currently, the state of Oregon, so the systems in the state of Oregon are wideband radio. We are having to go to narrowband by December 31st of 2012. And in fact, it will be unlawful for anyone to sell wideband radios after 2011 in the United States. The FCC has outlawed the sale of wideband radios at that time in preparation for the conversion date in 2013. We have to meet that date. If we don't, we could lose frequencies that we currently have and also lose federal grant opportunities. The system that we're putting in is land mobile radio, P25 digital trunked, with an OC3 Sonnet digital microwave backbone. It will provide data across the state of Oregon, as we're going to install the data conversion in all radio sites. We have we will have the capacity to support our local partners and the growth of state agencies' requirements, and it will be an open competition in life cycle procurement, proven reliabilities in emergencies. To give you an example, how many times have folks here in the room experienced their cell phone to crash? You can go to a U of O ball game and all at once your cell phone doesn't work just from the load of traffic that's on the system. The land mobile radio system that we're putting in will survive that type of capacity need. Land mobile radio survived 5 hurricanes in Florida, the Katrina hurricane in the Gulf. It has stood the test of time and will be what they refer to as five nines, which is 99.9995% of the time. It works. That means it'll only be down during the year on the average of 5 minutes out of 365 days. So I think we have the most reliable system that we can afford to put up, and it should work very well for us. As I mentioned earlier, we have 4 separate aging state communications systems. We have 95,000 square miles in the state of Oregon, 36 counties, diverse geography with challenging terrain topographies. And so I think if you just kind of take a look around Oregon in your mind, with all the mountain ranges, watersheds that we have, and radio communications basically works on line of sight, it doesn't bend around corners well. You'll see that we have a challenge with our geography. But with the system that we're proposing, which is high elevation, high power output, we feel that we can maximize the coverage with that system at the most economical price. On slide 8, you'll see some of the communication sites in Oregon. The upper left-hand corner and the lower right-hand corner are radio sites that are state-of-the-art, industry standard. If you look at the others, they're somewhat dilapidated, and those are the current sites that are supporting the state of Oregon. The upper right-hand picture shows a tower that broke in half. That was over in eastern Oregon near the town of Ontario. Wind blew that over. I've talked about the $665 million as being excessive. We have reduced that cost estimate today to $405 million by the state participating more in the construction with current state staff instead of just contracting that out to a person to do what is commonly referred to as a turnkey contract. And it was also estimated at $665 without the partnerships. And the partnerships, once again, I feel are a cornerstone of this project, and certainly has reduced the cost by $44 million. The 2008 legislature directed Owen to partner with the Northwest, Southwest, 7, and Central counties. There was $76 million of COP set aside. We were asked to return to the emergency board for approval of the $76 million limitation. That was accomplished in September, and there was a $76 million limitation approved, with $26.5 million being scheduled initially. Current established partnerships. Integrated Wireless Network. That is a federal program promoted by the Department of Justice as well as the Department of Homeland Security that we have partnered with. They have built a system of the microwave backbone down the I-5 corridor. We are currently using that system. We also have a Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission network that goes from Portland to Pendleton, as I mentioned earlier. The COPS grant has linked us with the Dalles to Bend to Salem, which creates a loop. And we have currently 35 local partnerships. Now, to tell you how fast this partnership has changed, we had 33 when we were in eBoard in September, and we've had 2 more come to us and want to join the partnership group. And we signed those up this last week. Page 12 shows you the list of partners. You can read through that, look at that at your leisure. The Western States Island Partnership concept, if you take a look at the map, this is also a first. And it illustrates what Oregon proposed to the U.S. Department of Justice and Homeland Security. To give you an example of what was required of the federal government, Congress directed shortly after 9/11 that the United States has a integrated radio network across the United States. That has not been accomplished yet. In my estimation, it's going to be wildly expensive, and that's been the struggle that the federal government certainly has had. Now, what I propose to the U.S. Department of Justice and U.S. Department of Homeland Security, that they partner with the states. And so one of the things that I did here a few months ago was I called my neighbors. Idaho was the first state I called, and asked if they would be interested in a sharing of the microwave system between Oregon, Washington, or Oregon and Idaho and Utah, and that we share that with the federal government at a cost to the federal government, of course. There has to be some participation from them in this process. Knowing that we have partnered with them on the I-5 corridor, and knowing that during the Olympic Games in Salt Lake a few years ago, the federal government built a system that linked Boise to Salt Lake. And with the Olympic Games in Canada, they have also built a system in Washington. And I've kindly referred to those as random acts of kindness by federal government, but there's no linkage between them. So we're really not getting the biggest bang out of what they've installed. And so we looked at the system. We talked about it amongst ourselves, among the four states, and we quickly concluded that the four states concluded a few months ago that we needed California as part of the group as well, so we recruited California, and that would provide a communications network for the whole West Coast with coastal states, and an inward eastward projection from the coastal states as well. Now, Oregon's pivotal in this. We sit right in the hub of these five states to make this work, and I've given a figure of 22.8 million to the federal government, that if they would build some of our infrastructure, they would be allowed to share our bandwidth and write our microwave system and have communication. No one in the state has come forth with that proposal before anywhere in the U.S. The federal agencies are very intrigued. They want to pursue it. Of course, I think everyone recognizes there's a change of administration and such, and so we're just kind of caught in a crossroads at this time. I've been back to D.C. On two occasions to talk about this type of a system. U.S. Department of Justice has traveled out to Portland and met with the five states and sat down with us and talked about a proposed plan. The schematic that you see here in front of you is what we would propose. Is what we have proposed to the U.S. Department of Justice and Homeland Security. I think it's a concept worth pursuing. There's not just would it help the federal government, but I think this is an important aspect of it as well. If we can put this system in, then we would have a direct communication link with our neighbors. And looking at a large disaster in the state of Oregon, and I've used Portland as an example, when the earthquake takes place, and from all the seismic monitoring that's been done and structure down under the surface of the earth, our geologists are telling it's going to happen. We need to be prepared for it. And I can call upon my neighbors and get a quicker response than I can from FEMA. I'm convinced of that from what I've seen around in other disasters around the country. And so if we have a serious disaster in a major metropolitan area, we're going to need the help from our neighbors, and we can do that with a communication system. Because I can assure you the commercial communication system won't stand up. It certainly hasn't stood up in other venues around the United States in a disaster time. I mentioned the drive tests of the 700 versus VHF. I won't belabor you with that anymore. Our plan objective and overview, I think we've covered that very well. On slide 16, there are those are the phases of Olin. Those are the timelines as to as we've identified for the build-out of the project. If you take a look at slide 17, phase one is depicted on the map. The maps, pictures, you know, speak a thousand words. That kind of describes where we are today. The immediate focus of Olin is to continue to work with partners to iron out details regarding the partnership. And we have accomplished some of that. Yesterday we met down at Coos Bay with the Southwest Seven Counties, and we detailed the sites and what each party and partner will participate in at each of those sites. One of the things that I think is extremely important is we, the county, the state owns sites, the county owns sites. It saves the state a lot of money from having to procure land to put radio towers and buildings on. And to give you an example, we of the cost of some of these sites, there is a location in Southern Oregon that we would like to be on. It's privately owned. We need to buy a 50 by 50 piece of ground on top of this knob. That's just a piece of rock, basically. The landowner values that property at $283,000 for a 50 by 50 foot piece of ground. So if the state was to have to purchase those kinds of locations around the state, we would just jack the price up. By sharing with the counties and local governments around the state, tribal governments and federal governments, we can reduce those costs. Another example of the partnership. We're establishing a project management office. We're going to complete the quality assurance RFP, request for proposal process. We need to establish project governance as well as long-range permanent governance for Olin, and that is something that we'll be talking with the legislative work group about as well. We need to complete the RFP for Phase 2 and continue work on policy option packages for Phase 2 during the 09 legislative session. So we'll be coming before the Ways and Means Subcommittee and hopefully the Ways and Means Full Committee with a proposal on Phase 2 after we start the process of Phase 1 implementation. With that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Chair Riley, that your committee may have.
Yes, Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Lindsay, thank you for the presentation and for the progress that's being made. When this was first starting out, it was causing a lot of angst for a lot of us. Obviously, the preparation is for an ultimate emergency, which means that you have capacity in the vast majority of the time that will be underutilized. And so when you talk about interoperability, is there the potential for utilization that goes beyond public safety, such as distance surgeries, medical utilization by the private sector to utilize a secure and a network of this type rather than just having to have life-threatening or life, you know, in the balance kind of issues utilizing the internet or something like that. So would you tell us about the expansion of interoperability beyond public safety?
Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, we have not elected to share our bandwidth with private industry. And there's a couple of reasons for that. We've already been challenged by private industry that we would be subsidizing private industry if we gave them bandwidth, because there are a lot of private companies out there who want to sell their bandwidth to private providers, and they don't want to compete with the state of Oregon. In addition to that, the 700 megahertz frequencies that we are using are set aside for public safety use only. That was specifically identified for public safety. And so I think there would be some issues associated with that use by private providers if we shared that bandwidth with them.
Certainly. We're talking about $405 million of taxpayer money. And so I think that we obviously need to be watching out of what's good for the citizens and not merely what may or may not be convenient. Potential competition is an issue. But when you talk about 700 megahertz bandwidth, you had also been talking about VHS. And so I got a little confused there. Is if we're going to go VHS, I thought that your study had indicated that if we went 700 megahertz, that would cost 30% more, and that VHS is also available. Are we talking about the same thing? I mean, I got confused at that point.
Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, don't feel bad about being confused, because this is kind of a confusing subject. The $665 million cost estimate that we were given through the study by Federal Engineering allowed for a hybrid system where we used VHF and 700. And the assumption at that time by the industries was that if you were going to go to a 700 system, that you would have to build out a system with 30% more infrastructure and radios than your current VHF. And also, the assumption was that 700 did not work well in forested mountainous country. The study that we did proved that VHF and 700 are almost identical in their propagation from the radio sites. So the coverage was almost identical. So since 700 is set aside specifically for public safety, we started looking at 700 with more enthusiasm, because the cost was the same, and it is a set aside for public safety specifically, and we will be licensed for 700. Now, sharing of that bandwidth, I would not recommend. I would share infrastructure, and we have plans to share infrastructure. We gave all of the private companies, communication companies, the latitude and longitude location of all of our radio sites. And we've asked them to look at those sites to see if there is any interest on their behalf to put an antenna on the site, etc., so that they can utilize the location. Because one of the things that we've learned is that if it's not, profitable for private industry to be at a location, they're not going to go there. And if they have to spend $500,000 to put up a tower and a site, they have to figure out, how am I going to recoup my money? But if I build the site for public safety, and then I lease to them at a reasonable cost, they can see their profit margin rise. And so they have seen that as an opportunity to partner with the state. To give you an example, and I've said I would like to use this as a model as to how Oregon needs to work with private vendors as well as multiple public entities. And the site is Neocone Mountain, over on the coast near Manzanita in the community of Nehalem. The site is owned by state parks. It's a mountaintop. It is a key radio communication site for the state of Oregon. It is part of our backbone. There are small local TV providers at that location, as well as AT&T and Verizon. Now, if the state wouldn't partner with them, there would be a big hole in some of the commercial communications opportunities in that area. And so the private providers have been meeting with us, working out solutions to the site, consolidating for the aesthetic value of the state park, consolidating into one tower, one building, or two buildings and maybe two towers from the multiple towers and buildings we have there now. And that is how I see the state of Oregon being a very strong partner with private industry.
That was the long answer. The short answer is, we're not going to have a hybrid system. We're going to have a 700 system.
Well, the short answer is certainly brief, but the amount of money we're spending is not it's not insignificant.
Right.
And part of what government, I believe, should do is to also watch out for citizens who may be in areas where it is not financially feasible to put in a system. For instance, if you're going to have distant medical care and treatment right. for John Day, there's never going to be enough money to buy the ability to utilize existing towers just because the whole infrastructure system to get that kind of connection there may be difficult. And so I just was hoping and have been saying this since this came along that when you get to areas of distance learning and distance medicine and those kinds of things that we need to do all in our power to make sure that this kind of an investment benefits more than just we're prepared in case of emergency, but also on a day-to-day basis because there's such a capacity.
And excuse me, but I believe that that will take place, and I believe that having the towers and the sites in place will allow the state, if we want to put in a separate radio or bandwidth communication for that purpose, will be a lot cheaper.
And Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, the way we've also looked at this, to so you can understand a little bit more, we've looked at the demand for the future as we've designed the system. Now, if you take a look back 10 years ago, and I think we're all very familiar with wireless communication with cell phones, and then just roll forward 10 years like we are today, the consumption rate of bandwidth and use has just been tremendous. You know, it's grown exponentially. And so one of the things that we're looking at is we may overbuild this system in some locations. Let me give you an example. If today we have a demand at a site for a capacity for a 120-foot tower, you know, where you hang microwave dishes, antennas, and we see that this location will probably grow in the next 10 years, given that the tower probably has a lifespan of at least 30 years, we should probably build the foundation of that tower for a 160-foot tower instead of 120, so we can add to the top of the tower. Saves us money, because if we have to come back in 10 years and put in a 160-foot tower, we're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars again, where we could initially spend a few tens of thousands to build a foundation for 160 versus a mere 120. We just add another 40 feet of structure on top of the existing 160 foundation, and we're good to go. But we can't do that if we have a 120 foundation. So there's going to be some decisions like that as we build this system out for growth.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Lindsay. Appreciate it.
Well, Chair, thank you for your time, and also thanks for the participation on the work group. As I mentioned, that's extremely vital to us, and I would encourage anyone to contact me. My contact information is on the last page if you have any questions.
Thank you. And, Lindsay, I want to ask you to sometime late this afternoon get in touch with me. I have something else I want to talk to you about.
I'll be available, Representative Riley.
Thank you. So we're going to move on to accountability and public contracting, I'm going to change the order a bit from what we have in front of us. I'm going to ask the departments to make their presentations first, if that's possible. Are the departments here and ready to do that? DAS and ODOT. So whenever you're ready, if you just identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Representative Riley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. With me today is Lorna Youngs from the Department of Transportation. We had studied the notes and the recommendations contained in the accountability proposals, and the Department of Administrative Services felt that our best effort would be to support the discussion and to be prepared to draw out the items that were commented on this today and to do further research and to be available to answer those questions. So I did not prepare a formal presentation for you, sir, and members of the committee. And I would say briefly that there are many controls contained in the Oregon Public Contracting Code. Both state and local agencies are required at various points in both the solicitation and contract administration process to confirm the responsibility of proposers, to make sure that they are performing to the levels expected in the resulting contracts that they obtain from public procurement efforts. And while there are many requirements currently, certainly it is obvious from the discussion before this committee that there are other issues and emerging questions about how accountability in contracting is not only currently handled, but perhaps should be handled in the future. We at the Department of Administrative Services provide rules, processes, consultation, and of course we do transactions work on behalf of many state agencies that probably gives us some insight into a statewide perspective. And again, we have a current system, but that system is always can always be improved. So with your permission, I would like to let Ms. Youngs go ahead and present some details from the Department of Transportation's perspective.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. I'm Lorna Youngs. I'm the Deputy Director for Central Services with the Department of Transportation. And what I wanted to do today was give just a brief overview of the contracting service contracts that the Department of Transportation that's what our process is and what accountability, kind of a flavor for the accountability and oversight that's in the existing process. We use personal services, trade services, and public work improvement contracts to obtain services that the agency needs. Personal services contracts can include hiring consultants to produce design for highways, architectural engineering designs, as well as planning and information technology services. Our trade services contracts can include such things as janitorial service, electricians, or work on the highway like debris removal or landscape maintenance. Then, of course, the bulk of the contracting that the department does is in the area of public works and public improvement, our construction contracting, and that's about $250 to $350 million contracts are awarded each year. These include contracts for things such as highways, bridges, or small-scale contracts such as paving overlays or culverts. And the under the area of what authorities the department has to contract, in the personal services arena, we have a for architectural and engineering contracts, we have procurement authority, but obtain DOJ approval of solicitation and our contract documents when the project is valued greater than $100,000. So there is oversight there in terms of the content of the contract. For personal services that are not considered architects and engineering, then we are contracting for things under $150,000. And if the project exceeds that threshold, then the contracting is handled by the Department of Administrative Services procurement. And also, as with the A&E contracts, all non A&E personal services contracts over $100,000 must receive a Department of Justice overview. In the trade services arena, again, we have a similar limitation. We internally contract for projects up to $150,000, and then beyond that, that contracting process is handled through the DAS procurement services. And again, we have the $100,000 threshold for DOJ review. Under Public Works, Public Improvement contracts, that authority to contract resides with the department. And we have been given a general exemption from DOJ review because we use a standard process and procedure. We have a specification manual that we use. And so there's very little variance in the contracts in terms of the actual language in there. And if we use, and primarily, of course, those are all low-bid contracts. If we use any other method other than the low-bid process, then we need a DOJ review of the solicitation. Under the accountability and oversight in general, our public works, as I said, and public improvement contracts, for the most part, are awarded to the lowest responsible bidder. That means prior to the procurement, the ODOT's procurement specialists are determining whether or not the bidders are actually responsive to the solicitation. And responsiveness means, did they supply all the information that we asked for in our bid specifications? Once we've determined that they are responsive to the bid, then we determine whether or not they are a responsible bidder. And in order to do that, then we are reviewing going to a number of sources, such as the Construction Contractors Board, Secretary of State Corporate Division, Bureau of Labor and Industries, list of ineligible contractors, and for federally funded projects, any of the excluded parties list that the federal government has established. We've developed a procurement process to help make sure that reasonable prices are obtained when we do have the contracts, and those are mostly personal service type contracts, where it's not a low bid, it's where we have based on qualifications and price is not the primary consideration. We've developed negotiation training, negotiation teams, and we've designated those teams in each of our regions to support that effort. We've also developed guides and templates for the contract specialists to work with, and they're part of the procurement file as documented for auditing purposes. We have a mixture of centralized and regional procurement specialists. Their personal services contracts must be processed by a procurement specialist, and they have considerable training in both state and federal procurement rules and regulations. They hold state and national certifications, many of them. The role of the procurement specialist is to ensure that the solicitation process and the procedures are done in accordance with applicable laws and rules, and that we have a fair and level playing field for all the prospective contractors, and, of course, most importantly, to encourage competition. We also have both internal and external auditing over our contracting process. We are subject to a broad range of auditing. We have our own internal audit service. The Secretary of State provides auditing, as well as federal agencies such as Federal Highway Administration audits our contracting process. And obviously, the focus of that is to improve operational accountability. And as we receive improvements, our recommendations for improvements, we follow up on those. We've also done it. Also, general training of our staff that are responsible for procurement in general or oversight. We've trained over 800 managers and supervisors in ODOT in general of fiscal and procurement management. So we have, as you can see, a very broad range of contracting activities in the department. We work closely with Department of Justice as well as Department of Administrative Services in our contracting processes, and we take very seriously our responsibility to provide the oversight and training in that process. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
One question. Representative Richardson.
Thank you for this information. As part of the oversight, do you always track the hours worked, or when you're entering into service contracts, is it basically, as a general rule, a contract for this result. We want to have these things done, and this is what it's going to cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it would depend upon the nature of the contract. If the contract were a product-based contract, then we would be tracking on the deliverables in the contract, where they are in their various stages. For example, if we were contracting for an IT product, the development of an information technology system, then we would be tracking on where are you in terms of the process, because they got a price that they were going to be paying for it ultimately. And so the hours that it takes them to produce it is their problem, because what we're judging them on is the ultimate product that they're delivering to us. Now, if we're contracting in another kind of personal services contract where we might be contracting for staff augmentation, then obviously we're going to be tracking by the hour.
Can I ask one follow-up on that?
Sure.
If there was to be a change in requirements so that every contractor and subcontractor had to track all the hours worked by every employee and report that number, would that affect, as far as your experience, those that would be able to bid and the cost of the contracts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I do not have enough knowledge of how much effort it would take to do that to be able to answer your question at this time. I think we'd have to do some analysis for that. Perhaps Ms. Lancaster could be more useful on that.
Representative Riley, Representative Richardson, if I could just piggyback on that comment. I think Department of Transportation is a fairly pro forma, fairly standard type of agency in what she's described in terms of current practice. The question you ask, in construction work, it is fairly straightforward where public works construction projects do require a fair amount of hourly reporting, payroll reporting, et cetera, to meet the current requirements of public works construction. In these other areas, such as information technology that Lorna has described here, she is correct. Most agencies, to my knowledge, do not capture that type of detailed hourly employee-related information. And so as we look at the legislative concept that is under discussion and some of the other items that you've been considering, we will want to do some more research, but our thought right now is that this is not the common practice, and so the committee members might want to be aware that this would require additional workload to ask agencies to obtain that. And again, we'd be glad to come back with more analysis of that question.
Representative Edwards, any questions?
No. Thank you.
I have one. If you don't require this kind of tracking of what work is being done, how many hours by what kind of employees, how do you know and how do you evaluate whether or not the next contract like this should be done in-house or given a contract?
Representative Riley and members of the committee, that is an extremely good question, and I would want to do some more thought about it. But generally, as Ms. Youngs has described, the focus of the contract is about performance. It is about outcome. And so in order to go forward, every time, as the committee may be aware, there are feasibility studies which are required when state agencies do certain types of work. And the threshold for that is currently set at $30,000, so that if a state agency anticipates a new type of work, they must complete a feasibility study. The question that I would want to go back and research a little further is about that repetitive follow-on contract, and I think if that gets at the heart of your question, I'd like to go back and do some further analysis of that
question. If you could get back to me with that, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sir.
Any further? Yes, you have a question, Representative Byer.
Thank you, and I'm not sure, and maybe I should just go offline. I'm aware of a recent project at DMV that they've been implementing that kind of went beyond the deadline and took a lot of staff work to try to get the program implemented. And I think that there was some back and forth between the provider of the program and the department. When you do this, and I don't, you know, I probably should just talk to you offline, but the additional staff time that was taken during the implementation of this project, was that figured in, and how do you account for all that when it comes right down to evaluating this project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, you're probably hit the heart of one of the difficulties that you face quite often with information technology projects. And in this particular instance, I think what you're referring to is the implementation of facial recognition. The problem that occurred on this particular contract was at the time in which, I mean, first of all, the company's been taken over about twice now. The original product was in a developmental stage as opposed to being actually off the shelf. And so you do find sometimes with particular contracts that what you start out with in the way of a contract and what you have start out in the way of expectations on both parties' side and what you end up with don't match, and you simply have to work through it. And so, no, we didn't. The department did not anticipate that the time it would take, though there were early indications that the company was experiencing some difficulties as they worked through how to adapt this particular software to the state of Oregon. And that's part of the issues that you also face with information technology contracts, is each state is unique. Their infrastructure that you add the software to is unique, and so you end up with some configuration issues that the company may not have anticipated. So these kinds of projects, as well as others, but more commonly in information technology, when you're remodeling systems, you find unexpected problems.
And I can vouch for that, having done many information technology projects in my career, that it's absolutely the case that you're always inventing something new. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing these projects. So that's always the case. The question, however, is not, in my mind, about these implementation of new products that don't quite come off the shelf, but in information technology, and in particular, the ongoing maintenance contracts that we have, the replacement contracts, and those are the ones that give me a little heartburn. So I think, you know, we want to look at those in much more depth. Further questions? Thank you very much. And if you could stick around for the rest of this testimony, someone may have questions for you later. Thank you. So I'm going to call Gordon Lafer, Bill Harris, both to the stand at the same time, if that's... Just to save time in the transition period here. And Gordon, if you could just go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Chairman Riley and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Gordon Lafer. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center and have been studying economic policy for more than 20 years. Over the last 5 years, one of the main research projects I've been engaged with is studying the economics of contracting out of school support services, meaning custodial food services and transportation in Oregon school districts. And the most recent report to come out of that research has just been distributed to you. A big part of the research that I did looked in detail at a number of case studies of contracting out, comparing the savings that were promised when the contracting out decision was made with what was actually delivered in the delivery of services. I don't want to go into too much of the detail, but let me say from the beginning, we did not find a single case in which the savings promised were realized. In every case, they were significantly less, and in several of the cases, it actually ended up costing the school district more to have made the decision to contract out than to keep the services in-house. The information that we uncovered, I think, is critically important for a variety of audiences, for school districts considering contracting out, for legislators, for parents and taxpayers. But without the kind of thing that is now being proposed, which is to have this information available in a searchable database, it is very slow, very difficult, and very cumbersome to come by. We spent many months doing this research, and as you can imagine, it's a lot of phone calls to business managers of school districts who are overworked and overtaxed, and their secretaries who have things filed from years ago in different places and have a lot else to do. It takes a long time, took many, many months to dig up this information. I think it's critical information, and I want to just go briefly over some of the things that we found that I think would be so valuable if they were available online. And the first set of people I think it would be so valuable for is school districts themselves when they're considering contracting out. And there's a couple things I want to explain about what that is like. What most often happens is that you have negotiations between, on the one hand, a huge multinational corporation like Sodexo and Laidlaw with a local school district. So you have somebody on the one hand who only does this one thing. All they do is food services, and they've done it 1,000 times in districts all over the country. And on the other hand, you have the business manager for a school district who has 1,000 other responsibilities and has never done this thing before. What also frames this is that at the very moment that school districts are considering contracting out is generally because they've had some kind of budget crisis, and that same budget crisis often results in layoffs at the managerial level, which means the school district's ability to do their own investigation and monitoring of a contractor is eroded because they're suffering the same budget crisis as the district as a whole. Some of the things we found out, Sodexo, which provides food services, was charging significantly different rates of cents per lunch to one school district than another for providing the exact same food and the exact same services for school lunches. Now, the districts negotiating these contracts have no way of knowing this. I assume it would be fairly easy if they knew to insist on getting whatever the lowest rate is for other districts, but they have no access to the information. In another case, there's a company called SBM, a custodial company that was hired by Lincoln County in 2003 among a lot of doubts about its ability to carry off the job. And in a step that was very unusual, 6 months into the contract that was supposed to be a three-year contract, the district canceled it. And there were a lot of rumors about and a lot of complaints from teachers, but the reasons for canceling the contract were kept secret, and the Board of Education was sworn to secrecy. This company has gone on to bid in other districts in the state and, I believe, win contracts in other districts in the state. And those districts, again, have no access even to the fact that this contract was canceled, much less to the reasons for which it was canceled. There have also been issues that come up in small print that I think would be important for other districts to know about. We often found contracts where it was announced there's a guaranteed savings of a certain amount of money, and then in the fine print you see that guarantee is premised on certain conditions being met. In some contracts, the conditions that the guarantee was premised on were things that everybody knew from the beginning were going to be false. For instance, there are contracts that said, our guarantee is premised on the fact that the state minimum wage will not increase during the life of the contract, when we already had a law saying every January the minimum wage is going to be indexed to inflation. Or it said it's premised on a certain level of enrollment, where enrollment had already fallen below that in the district. So the ability to get, I mean, every place that contracting out is considered, every place that I've seen, there's this great trumpeted guaranteed savings. You have that kind of language. The ability of districts who are in that position to be able to see what happened in other districts where there was a promise of savings and what actually materialized, how much did they actually save or what did they actually cost, is critical for a district to be able to make its decision about whether to contract out or whether to go with a particular contractor. All of that information is theoretically in the public record, but no school district has the time to do what we were able to do. I mean, they shouldn't have to be professors and graduate students who take months and months and months to dig up the information. They don't have the capacity to do that. So simply by making this available online, I think would put school districts in a much more competitive position to be able to decide whether to contract out, and if so, to negotiate the terms of the contract. One of the other places that that I think could benefit from this even is the state superintendent of education. One of the most troubling things that we came up with, which I believe is now being looked at to see whether it's a violation of the law, is school districts, and we uncovered this in the Lake Oswego district, where they had a contract where the district was essentially buying a whole fleet of buses for Laidlaw, for a private company that would be Laidlaw's private property that they could use outside the district for any other business purposes that they wanted to, and it was being paid for out of the state transportation fund, which in certainly the intention of the statute as it's written was only to pay for buses that would be the property of the district and not to pay for buses that would be the property of private companies. When I called Superintendent Castillo's office and I spoke to the person who oversees transportation, she said, tell me where this is happening. And is it happening anyplace else? And the first I was surprised. I thought, well, don't you have a file someplace that has all of the contracts? And the answer was no. And it's one person. She doesn't have a staff to say, well, let me investigate everything. And the question of where else is this happening, I don't know. I only know the places that I investigated. So that even the superintendent of education, confronted with something that, in their opinion at the time, was at least legally questionable, is handicapped in being able to investigate where else might this be happening, and it could be done very easily if they had an unsearchable database without having to increase the investigatory staff of the superintendent's office. The last thing I want to mention is that I think could be helped by increased transparency is that in our research, sometimes the most important things we found were things that were not there. So, for instance, in one of the custodial contracts we found, you know, one of the key questions in contracting out that anybody asks is, what are we going to get for our money? In custodial work, the answer to this is, you have a contract that says, here are the standards of cleanliness that will be guaranteed in different kinds of buildings and different kinds of spaces. And if the contractor doesn't meet this, here are the penalties that will be incurred, and here's how it will be monitored. I was surprised to find that in many cases, those standards were left for the contractor themselves to write. So, this was a Sodexo contract I looked at for custodial care. And the contract said after they had been awarded the contract, they would do the study and say, here's the standards of cleanliness. Then they said they would publicize those to teachers and principals and conduct a customer satisfaction survey, and they would come up with a method for how much they should be penalized if they failed to meet those standards. Apart from, for me, I feel like the shocking idea that you basically give a contractor the right to write their own job description and say, you know, it's like you say to a kid, what do you think your punishment should be? The more surprising thing was that, in fact, none of these things were ever done. They never wrote up standards of cleanliness. They never publicized them to anybody. There never were customer satisfaction surveys, and there never was any mechanism designed to say, what should the penalty be if you don't meet these standards? Now, the fact that these are missing, even the fact that they don't exist, was only something that we were able to uncover through this cumbersome month-long process that I think is important information for rate, maybe for legislators to know, certainly for other districts who might be considering entering a similar relationship to know, that could be easily and quickly and costlessly known if these things were available on the database. And it seems to me information that's important to taxpayers and parents and legislators as well. So with that, I won't walk you through the long, detailed study, but I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Harris?
Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is Bill Harris. I live at 2803 Northwest Cumberland Road in Portland, Oregon. I am here to read a report from Janice Thompson, who cannot be present today. She is Executive Director of Democracy Reform Oregon. I am a volunteer supporter of that organization. Now, Janice's words. Well, first, Democracy Reform Oregon is an organization that addresses Post Office Box 2723, Portland, Oregon 97208-2723. And now Janice's words. My apologies for not being able to testify in person at your October 17, 2008 hearing on this important governmental transparency legislative proposal, especially since I also had a conflict last year and couldn't attend the hearing on this bill at the 2007 session. Democracy Reform Oregon is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit group working to increase accountability and opportunities for participation in politics and government decision-making. Governmental transparency and public access to information, such as government contracts, is an important concern of our organization. House Bill 3366, introduced with bipartisan sponsorship during the 2007 session, is an important step forward to meet governmental transparency goals. This bill could be improved in two ways. Number one, the maintenance of records described in House Bill 3366 should be in a database that is available in a searchable format on a website to allow for public access of information on government contracts. Number two, require local governments to provide contract information in a searchable website. This could take the form of a locally produced database and website that includes the records specified in House Bill 3366, or by providing the option of allowing local governments to enter data into the state system with a link from a local government website to the state website. The development of such state databases and websites is a growing trend seen also at the federal level. The Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act, adopted in 2006 with bipartisan sponsorship of Senators Barack Obama and Tom Coburn, ordered the U.S. Office of Management and Budget to construct an internet destination for the general public to track the flow of federal grant and contract disbursements. This effort is supported by the National Taxpayers Union, that produced an issue brief highlighting exemplary state websites tracking state grants and contracts in Arizona, Connecticut, Indiana, Kansas, Nebraska, North Carolina, and Washington. These states also received high grades in a study of online disclosure of state contracts by Corporate Research Project of Good Jobs First. In other words, organizations from two ends of the ideological spectrum agree on the importance of this category of public disclosure. The Corporate Research Project gives Oregon's current contracts online disclosure a C-minus grade. This is because the ORPIN website is not designed with public transparency in mind, but is intended for use by contractors and requires a password. Our neighbor to the north, Washington, was highlighted in both studies, and their websites presented as a good model. I have listed in the testimony that I will hand in the specific website. For example, making it good is the fact there are several search options provided and a broad range of information readily available. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. Let me know if I can help with follow-up questions, says Janice. I will be glad to write down any question that we have at this time, and have a plan and have arranged with her to have the answer back to you next week.
Any questions for him to write down? Thank you very much. We have her contact information. And
you have the contact information in the written presentation, and the two studies referred to in the next to last paragraph. In the next to last paragraph are also available.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mark Friedmark?
My name is Mark Tremark, and I'm head custodian at Llewellyn Elementary School. Bear with me, I'm a little nervous. I'm not a very well good public speaker. I work for Portland Public Schools. I've worked there since 1985, and nobody knows more about the contract and that issue on the effect on employees or on the district than a Portland Public School custodian. We were contracted out in 2002. After 10 years of whittling away at our department, we had approximately 700 custodians who were responsible for over 175 buildings and took care of approximately 50,000 students. After ballot measure 5 was passed in the 90s, our monies were drastically cut to Portland Public Schools, and everybody had to look for places to either save or cut funding. In 2002, I'm also a member of SEIU Local 140. In 2002, I was an evening custodian at Lynn Elementary School when I first heard that we were considering contracting out our jobs. And that year we had really been cut that year, and finally management came to us and said, we're going to have to do less with less. You know, we don't have enough people to get the job done every day. And we said, well, we need to hire some more people. And they said, well, we just don't have the money, so you guys are going to go to every other day cleaning now. And, you know, of course, we didn't want to do that. We really care about these schools and, you know, been there for, you know, 20-something years. And my first boss there, his job was shoveling coal into the boilers in the 50s. And back then, you started out really slow, your responsibility. But I finally made it to a head custodian after 14 years working there, and it's really hard to say what I do as a head custodian, but I think the most important things I do are not even stuff I listed here, but it's, you know, band-aiding kids, finding their coats, cleaning their shoes when they step in feces from the grounds. Just as a surrogate father, I look at all the children at my schools. You know, I'm like a surrogate dad to them, and I can tell right away when they come through the door if they've had a bad day or a bad morning or what's going on. But back to the contracting out, and so we all sat down and we don't have enough money to keep you guys, and so we negotiated. The contractor said, well, we can save you $5 million a year, we'll do everything those guys do. And so we tried our hardest, and we came to the district with savings of over $6 million by cutting our benefits, by being one of the first ones to offer a freeze in our health care cap. So in a 7-month period, I don't know what studies, I wasn't involved in that, but after 65 years of Local 140 taking care of the schools and never having a serious problem, we were outsourced. And it was, you know, it was devastating not only to the workers but to the schools. And you know, we rallied and fought, and we tried to show, you know, how important we are to the schools. And how I first became a custodian, when I was a kid, we'd be bored at night. We'd all go to the hangout at the school, and the custodian there was just a wonderful man. And he used to say, hey, it's raining out. Why don't you guys, kids, come in and play basketball in our gym? And he'd let us sweep, and he let me use the scrubber one day. And my dad was a contractor, and I did a lot of work for him, but in the 80s, you know, it was tough to find a job, and I saw that they were hiring at the school district, and I thought, you know, I'm going to give that a try, and it was the most rewarding job I ever had. I wasn't teaching kids. I'd never want to do that job because that is the toughest job, but it was just so rewarding, and, you know, I couldn't fathom that after all the hard work we put in that they wanted to put us out, and we were old, tenured. By that time, you know, through the cuts, what was left of our department was a lot of, you know, people that started in the 60s and early 70s, and, you know, they were Tier 1 PERS members, and, you know, that's all we know. I mean, there's not school custodians are, you know, it's a unique job. You get a school, and every school is different in its own unique way, and your place in that school is different. You can't write a contract that says what we do, and you can't say exactly. I mean, everything changes every day, from maybe a bomb threat or a child getting hurt, or I fix a lot of bikes. I pop a lot of balls, pick shoes up off the roof, walk teachers out to the car late at night, walk the roof on Halloween to make sure, you know, yeah, we see you down there, take that somewhere else. We've got kids walking around. So it was just really hard to fathom that somebody else could come in and do our jobs with the same passion as we were. Okay, but back to, so by after offering them, you know, 10% reduction in our pay, we were ended up being contracted out. And, I'm sure a lot of you know the plight of the Portland school custodians. And finally, the Supreme Court said that we were illegally fired, not laid off, and we were given a chance to come back to our schools. And my children go to Portland Public Schools. I was the head custodian 3 blocks from my house, and so it was a community thing to me. And it's really sad to even talk about it now, how much my family was hurt. But when I came back, I was just appalled. I didn't initially come back to a school. I was a closed site because a lot of schools have been closed. But driving around the district, the grasses were this tall. I'd had to climb on roofs, and I'm like, God, did anybody ever... I mean, there was trees, literally trees growing off roofs. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if they were doing all of our jobs, who was doing this? And it wasn't until I finally went back to a school, and which was Llewellyn Elementary School, and the mice, I'd open in the morning, and they were just everywhere. And I'd call, and I'd say, what's going on here? And, well, it's so filthy here. And I'd move furniture, and there's food behind it. And this is at opening of the school year, you know, where we would clean that school from top to bottom all summer. That's what we do. I mean, everything is washed. And the conditions were just appalling. And one day my kindergarten teacher called me up, and she said, we have a mouse stuck in one of the kindergartners' hair. They were taking their nap. And I said, enough is enough. We trapped over Christmas break and caught over 100 mice in that school. And, you know, just to, you know, I'm not saying there was anything wrong with the company or the workers, because a lot of those workers now work for Portland Public Schools, and they're great people. But until you live working for a public as a public employee, and how serious we take our jobs, and the oversight that the public has watching us, and our merit that we have, we really need to watch and be careful when we contract out jobs, because it's so hard to put. I can't. My job description doesn't say I'm a mouse keeper or a shoe tire or a Band-Aid putter. Or it's just so hard to put public jobs into classifications, because we pretty much do everything that nobody else is doing. We're unique in each building. Back to the quick runoff, I'm sorry. But also, when we left, the district had approximately $25 million worth of deferred maintenance. On our return, that had grown to over $250 million. And those costs aren't put on paper anywhere showing that it was a direct result of the custodians being contracted out. But a lot of it is. It's things that the coat of paint that I might have put on a window or saw the leak that caused the roof to fail. We had several incidences of untrained people, boilers melting down, oil spills, and the district said, well, that'll get better when these guys get more experience. Well, we had experience. We were the frontline people for that school. I'm the first one that kids see and staff sees in the morning, and my staff at night's the last one that people see there. Did it, in retrospect, save any money? No. They ended up having to pay a $14.5 million settlement to bring us back to work. That was, I'm a taxpayer, and it was just really disheartening to see the conditions, what happened. And the people that contracted out our jobs, they're not there anymore. They're high-paid, college-educated people, a few bucks more somewhere else. They left. But we were always there. And, you know, we before you can teach school children, you have to have a safe, warm, and secure environment. Everybody knows me in the school. And one day the superintendent decided to spend a day with the custodian, and she happened to choose my school. And everybody knows me because I'm Mark. But the superintendent walking through the school had, is that your mom? And I said, no, this is the superintendent of schools. We were that important. But we need more transparency when we contract out. They really need to be looked at to find out what is going on and why. Things that, you know, you can't write a contract saying, oh, well, we're going to do everything those folks did. You can't list that. You can kind of have an idea, but, you know, in my field, the custodian, the best custodian, you don't know he was there that night. It's all done every day for you. You come in and you're warm and you're... what else am I after? I know I'm getting off of what I thought I was going to talk about, but I'm... other hidden costs I contracted us out that the district hadn't realized that they were self-insured through their unemployment. Costs of $1.7 million when we were, they call it layoff, but we were illegally fired. The maintenance, our equipment was sold to the company for $20,000. That's equipment that we had. Some of it was, you know, 40 years old, some of the heavy-duty custodial equipment. When we came back to work, we no longer owned any equipment. We had custodians buying their own supplies, buying their own vacuums. And subsequently, we leased the equipment back for the first year for $100,000 that we had sold for $20,000, and then subsequently had to purchase new equipment at approximately $2 million so we could come back and do our jobs. But the biggest loss was in the experience of people that actually worked in the schools and knew the schools. These schools are all different. A lot of our boilers are from World War I ships, and it takes an experienced man that knows this equipment, and just by sounds, what's going on in these plants. We had a few near misses where if one of these boilers would have set off, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of when a boiler comes flying through a basement and goes through three stories of a building, but it leaves, you know, quite a bit of damage. And I think that's all I wanted to say is that please, you know, make sure there's more transparency and that the process is really looked at before, because I know people, you know, in short money times, it's easy when somebody comes in and says, I'll do that. But we really need to look really hard at what's going to be done, and to make sure that even that the contractors that come in are making a decent wage and livability. And if you had any questions, I'd answer them.
Thank you, Mark.
Sorry, I ran off the page.
That's all right. Any questions for...
Thank you for your career. You know, I mean, you are changing lives and affecting them every day. We have school districts that have school board members that are elected by the people to represent the needs of that school district, and they made a decision, and it sounds like, you know, in retrospect, you know, looking back in hindsight, it wasn't a profitable one or an effective one. It didn't accomplish what they wanted to do, and the way it was negotiated, it sounds like it wasn't negotiated very well. But what you're simply essentially saying is that we should not allow local elected leaders to make those kinds of decisions without the state requiring a much greater involvement in it, because certainly if there was complete disclosure, it still would not go to the level of all of the services that you provide. I mean, that's not in your job description to chase mice or to take manure off of somebody's shoe or something like that. You have to do it because you care about your job, but that's not something that can be included in legislation.
Exactly.
And so essentially, though, what you're really asking is that the state not allow such decisions that could have such devastating effect to be made by local leaders.
Well,
is that right?
You know, I know they have the power to make those decisions, but they really have to be looked at. And people that are, our department had more tenure in the school district than anybody. I mean, it's really hard work, it's back-breaking work, and the system work. And we started out as young. When I first started out, I humped a lot of furniture up and down the stairs and up and down ladders. And, you know, with the promises, as I got older, there was a PERS retirement going to be there for me. And, you know, with the workload, I saw my boss at the workload went down. You know, when you're 50 years old, I'm almost there. You know, it's kind of tough to lift 200-pound tables up the stairs, and we're so short. There's anymore, there's only one person in the building at a time, and you know, it's just what I'm trying to say is we really need to look at these contracts, and because they're at one end, they're going to make a profit. They're in business to make a profit, and they're in business to make the most profit that they can make off of the contract. And you know, the promises that are written down in papers or talked about don't seem to pan out when it comes down to reality. And the reality is that state workers are very valuable employees before they're contracted out that should really be looked at.
Mark, let me ask you a question before you go. Do you believe that the bill that we're proposing, which would look at as the contract is being worked by the successful bidder, if those reports were available, do you believe that that would be valuable information for other school districts to look at before they made these decisions?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. And I would hope that, you know, we have one of the oldest fleets of school buildings in the country. And, you know, the school I'm working at now was first put into service in 1924. And it's a real school, and it's a, in a real neighborhood. And, you know, parents expect and deserve a decent school for their kids to go to. And even though our building's 1924, not one of the parents in the neighborhood would ever like to see that building tore down or... That's
the case almost every school that I've ever seen. Are there other questions? Representative Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to be clear because I want to push back a little bit on the statement that this is not going to allow local school districts and school boards to make decisions. I think this is just a tool to make it a little more open and a little more information available for them to actually make these decisions that are good decisions for their districts.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Ask me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not Monica Godsey, as you all know. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Monica could not take a day off work to be here today, and so I'm going to sort of pitch it, and my testimony is going to be different than what you're getting, just based on some information that I know the committee wanted to have. I want to start, though, by saying that if you look, one of the things I did is I looked up the definition of government as defined by Webster's and by Britannica. And interestingly enough, Britannica defines government as the political system by which a country or community is administered and regulated. And, you know, we sort of look at government from our perspective as the entity that is responsible for the goal of providing for the common good, regardless of your ability to pay. And whether it's maintaining a strong road and transportation system or assuring clean water, clean air, and developing protective services for children and the elderly, government is there to provide for the services that maintain an orderly society. And a good governmental system should be and is nearly invisible to the citizens who live in the community. And while we may argue about the efficiency and the quality of the delivery of services, rarely do we argue over the need for those services or for the core fundamental principles that those services are in existence. We are, at AFSCME land, we rarely find contracting out as a good example of the way to administer government. But I know that's shocking. And, you know, I would be disingenuous if I said anything different than that. And you would not believe me if I said anything different than that. But I will tell you that there have been cases where, even at AFSCME land, we have supported contracting out. And we support it when there is a short-term need for highly specialized services, where there is no ongoing need for the service that is to be provided. We have supported it in cases where it just simply made no sense. For example, in Clackamas County was looking at the purchase of a blacktop, what do they call them?
Milling machine, a grinder.
Yes, a grinder, milling machine. And they were talking about purchasing this new machinery. It was hugely expensive. And our road crew actually came forward and said, this makes no sense. We should contract this work out to the private sector. And the savings that was realized within Clackamas County allowed us to maintain a full crew of maintenance workers. And the argument that we took to the city or to the county commission was that by maintaining a full crew of maintenance workers, we would be able to more efficiently and effectively respond to emergency situations due to weather or unforeseen problems that may occur. And we actually were successful in convincing the county commission not to purchase the new equipment, but rather to contract out that portion of the contract or of that portion of the work to a private contractor, and we maintained the maintenance department, and to this day continue to maintain the maintenance department. You know, another example is probably not as pleasant. That has been our argument, consistent argument over the contracting of human services. We were vehemently opposed to the contracting of mental health services and the developmentally disabled services provided at Fairview Training Center and Damage State Hospital to the private sector. We saw that as a wholesale way of just simply contracting out professional services to the lowest bidder. We saw it at placing our clients at risk, and that community group homes, while it looks good on the surface, was not a way to provide long-term care, and that it would place long-term clients at risk of substandard services. And Michael will talk a little bit more about some of the specifics that we've experienced. But in the end, we really have been proven right, unfortunately. Our clients now still consider, receive institutionalized care. Unfortunately, they receive it in county jails and in the state prison system. And we don't find that to be a very good alternative. What we would like to see, and I think what this bill starts the process of doing, is providing for a much more transparent process of contracting and allowing us to look at what we're going to contract, what we're going to get in way of a contract, what we can expect to get in services. our concerns long term are that too often what we've seen is contracting as a way, the way you save money in contracting is you cut the wages, you eliminate the benefits, and you create a new group of workers who are living at or close to the poverty line. And you've replaced a workforce that has made family wages and earned family benefits through their employment. What we see as an alternative is to require that those contractors provide the same level of wages and benefits so that you do not place a section or a new group of workers at or in poverty. And that when we make decisions to contract out, we ought to be making those decisions because it's a better way to deliver services, not because it's just a way to save money. If you can save money in the process, then that is a benefit that we should all look at. Now, in the city of Portland, there was a proposal to contract out the Portland Water Bureau and many of the services that they provided. We stepped in and said, we want the opportunity to bid on those jobs. We think we can do the work in a better way. We think we can provide services at a less, in a more cost-effective manner. Give us the opportunity. We spent about 2 years with the Portland Water Bureau in developing a whole new system in the Portland Water Bureau. And today, we actually were successful in bidding for our own jobs. We provided the services through a contract agreement. And to this day, those jobs are still city jobs done differently. The Portland Water Bureau today is a lot leaner. It's a little meaner, but it's a lot more effective. And people did not lose their jobs as a result of it. We did a phase out. We provided some early retirement programs for the older workforce. And we were able to reduce the workforce in a way that did not negatively impact long-term career employees, but still provided for a new and different way to provide the service. Now, interestingly enough, there were some cranky private contractors who filed suit. And in the end, we prevailed in those suits. And our contracts have stood. And in the end, the Bull Run Watershed is still owned and operated by a public entity. It is not owned and operated by a private entity. And, you know, if you've never been up there, you should go up there. It's a very fascinating place, and it's highly secure. So you can't just drive up. You got to, like, make arrangements. But the Bull Run Watershed is incredibly beautiful, and it's a valuable public resource that should never have been turned over to the private sector in a for-profit environment. Interestingly enough, public contracting oftentimes impacts a segment of the workforce that we as government have provided opportunities to when no one else would. The Center for the Political Studies in Washington, D.C. released an interesting breakdown of the governmental workforce. And I just want to read these statistics for you, but they're in the packet that I've handed out. 27% of all African Americans in the workforce work for government. 15.2% of all Latinos work for government. 53.5% of all black professionals and managers work for governmental bodies. And 28.9% as compared to 28.9% of white professionals. 21% of women. And 50% of all professional women as compared to 35% of professional men. 50% of women working in government earn 20% more, and minority women earn 30% more, and minority men earn 20% more. Because women and minorities are oftentimes the last hired, they're usually the first terminated. And so when you're contracting out governmental work you oftentimes impact the portion of the workforce that has the most difficulty finding other jobs. And in the private sector, it is very challenging for this workforce to move over. And so we want to take a look at not just sort of the costs, but also the impacts long term on a workforce that needs some that needs to have those jobs, and who we are displacing and what their alternatives are. The other thing that we should look at, and I know that the committee is interested in, is the hidden costs of contracting out. One of the things that we did with the Portland Water Bureau was we required that the private contractors include in their bid costs the costs that nobody thinks about. And that is, if you contract out janitors, for example, the cost of running the schools doesn't necessarily go down. You still have fixed costs. You still have to pay for the school board. You still have to pay for the governmental entity itself. You still have to pay for the cost of running a county commission, the cost of running a city council, the cost of running state legislature. Those costs don't go away because those are fixed costs that taxpayers must pay to run government. You don't go away just because we contract out a piece of state agencies. And those can run 25% to 30% of the overall contract. And so in Portland, when you bid on a contract in Portland, you have to add in a factor for the fixed costs of running and a functional government body. So those are some of the examples of some of the hidden costs that exist, whether or not you provide that service or whether you have a private contractor provide it. So, you know, we would like to say that one of the things that as you work through contracting that's important for us is that the system be accountable, that it be transparent, and that it be fair. And that if we have to account for 25% cost of government, then the agency or the private contractor who's bidding on the work should also have to pay those same costs. DAS is going to exist whether or not state employees are here, whether or not we provide all the services. They still have to be paid for. And so those costs should be incorporated into the private contract as well. And we just want a system that is fair, that is open and honest. And I'm anxiously awaiting the questions from Representative Richardson, but I will stop talking now.
I'm going to ask that we hold our questions until the other panelist has made his presentation, and then we'll ask the questions of both.
Straight face.
Both.
I'm impressed.
And I'm proud of you, Representative Richardson.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Riley and members of the committee. My name is Michael Danner, and I'm a council representative with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. Under contract with the state, Coast Rehabilitation Services operates 19 residential homes, providing training and support in employment, social skills, home, and community living skills in a community-based setting to adults with developmental and other disabilities. AFSCME represents Coast's 177 line staff or direct support employees. 122 of those employees earn $10 per hour or less. Of those same 177 employees in the bargaining unit, 76 of them have worked for Coast for less than 1 year, which is pretty typical turnover for this organization historically. Coast's direct support staff earn an average wage of $9.47 per hour, and these low-wage employees pay several hundred dollars per month toward their health insurance premiums. Coast generously ensures that their management personnel enjoy fully employer-paid health care coverage. For months months, AFSCME has been engaged in protracted negotiations with Coast for a successor contract. During bargaining, Coast has readily acknowledged that its direct support employees are underpaid, and they've conceded that the organization suffers from a very high turnover rate, although this has been said to be a very low concern because they come in just under the turnover rate for the industry as a whole. So that's generally a little concern of the organization. During the last biennium, the employees and AFSCME partnered with Coast to secure funding with the from the legislature, part of which was specifically dedicated to increasing wages and benefits of this badly underpaid staff. A detailed budget note specifically directed that these funds were intended to include a $1 per hour raise for staff and an increase in their benefits from 27% to 36% of OPE or other payroll expense. Despite this very clear legislative instruction, Coast, during bargaining, steadfastly failed and refused to pass along these funds that the legislature provided to improve for the purpose of improving recruitment and retention of these very underpaid staff. Adding insult to injury, during negotiations, Coast has utilized the additional funding to add additional management positions and to prop up and extend their budget across all categories except for staff wages and benefits, all the while offering, during negotiations, just token wage increases on the order of 30 cents per hour and an increase to the level of benefits on the order of $50 per month reduction of the employee's share of health insurance coverage. Alternatively, they've offered a 15 cent per hour increase, which would include a $50 per month increase in the monthly insurance coverage payment. During bargaining, Coast and AFSCME reached impasse. We're now in the midst of mediation in an attempt to resolve our differences, but settlement appears very unlikely. Coast continues to take the position that this money directed by the legislature to be spent specifically in the benefit of the employees for the purpose of improving service delivery, namely increasing quality of care and retention among the staff. And it has claimed that consistently that because this was merely a budget note, it's just a suggestion by the legislature, and that is, since it's not technically binding upon Coast, it can safely just ignore it. That's made a very tough sledding for bargaining. When the state places these critical governmental functions into the private sector, particularly where we're dealing with service delivery to some of our most vulnerable citizens, oversight, accountability, transparency, and control are significantly compromised. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Richardson?
Thank you. I was okay until you said, I just want fairness. Am I understanding correctly that the bidding requirement that you've mentioned in Portland says that if a private company were to bid on a contract, they have to add a surcharge of X percentage to help factor in the cost of government? And so if you have a city and they say, we want to, contract out one aspect, maybe it's food preparation, some issue like this, that by contracting that out, it would be unfair for a private enterprise not to have to pay part of state government as part of the bid. I mean, and yet, if there was an open bidding process and the government entity that's providing that were to bid on it, they wouldn't add that surcharge. And so I don't understand how, I mean, that's stacking the deck against a private contractor, not fairness, because it doesn't change the cost of government whether there is some, whether that service, whatever it might be, is provided by the government or by private enterprise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, maybe I stated that badly. We do add the same cost onto our bid.
Because I have the same opinion, by the way.
No, when the Portland Water Bureau bid on when we did our own internal bid, we included those costs as well. Historically, the private contractors have not had to include that cost.
And why did you have to include that cost? I'm also unclear about this. Okay.
This is the outline for how they did the program, and it was an effort to level the playing field for everybody, that everybody had to include all the same costs, and that the savings had to be realized through increased productivity, not through artificial cuts.
Of course, artificial cuts, so that include the cost of PERS compared to other types of retirement. I mean, if you say it has to be identical, then what you're essentially doing is preventing the possibility of reducing the cost of a service through open competition, because you know, you're saying, well, no, you have to meet the same level, and so now the costs are going to be the same, which is one of the reasons that you do make those changes.
We would argue, not necessarily to an agreement with everybody, but we would argue that when you eliminate a retirement, then you are transferring the cost of senior care to the overall public at large, and that the way you provide for reasonable care at retirement is you provide a livable retirement benefit for the workforce, and that by eliminating the retirement benefits of a section or a sector of workers, all you've done is transfer the cost of the care at retirement to the larger public entity, so that we all pay for the cost of seniors who live in or at poverty, and that the way to avoid that is to provide for a decent retirement, and that it is unfair to say that we're going to hire a group of private sector folks who don't get any retirement benefits or who get very little in retirement benefits with a group of workers who do get a retirement benefit. And so we said you have to provide economically. You cannot just simply save money by reducing the wages and benefits of the workforce. You have to show that you can save money in other areas.
Mr. Chair, I'm just saying that it is essentially stacking a deck, because it's not this or nothing. It's this or not an alternative way to do it that might be portable, you know, have some control over investment, those kinds of things. So I see this as stacking the deck in favor of the status quo, and just, of course,
fortunately, it has nothing to do with the bill we're going to look at.
Although the bill that we're looking at has a number of provisions in it that are so burdensome to private enterprise that they essentially will prevent private enterprise from being able to effectively bid, I think, in a lot of ways. You just mentioned that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, you and I can have this, you know, debate privately, certainly, and we will. But
for years, we have.
Yes. But we've done so with respect and dignity. I think that currently the deck is stacked against public sector workers, that there is no ongoing accountability for those entities which are now doing the jobs that were once done by public sector workers. So if you look at in an operation like Coast Rehab, where you have an entity who has taken the funds from a governmental institution and said, we're going to provide these services in the community and we're going to do a better job. If you do that with a 60% turnover, where once a client could be a client and their family were assured that the same person would be caring for that person for 20 years, they now have the assurance that the same person will be caring for the client for 6 months. That is not in the client's best interest, nor is it in the best interest of us, generally speaking. We need to be able to provide some continuity and quality of care, and we're not doing that.
Which is certainly a separate issue than...
She brought that up because she knows I supported that pay increase because
no,
I didn't
I
want that 60%.
I know you did.
Yeah, and I think that's...
These are not easy issues to deal with to make this fair and not have the pendulum swing to one side or the other.
They're not, which is why and during the last session I asked for the report from DAS that I asked for, which was to compare not what the benefits are to the workforce, but what are the benefits to the taxpaying public, and that was fairly clear as well. But I think that what we want to do is are there other questions of this panel? Thank you very much. Last person we want to hear from, I think it's Chris Meyer. Okay. Thank you.
Chairman Riley and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Please bear with me. I've never spoken to a committee before, so I might blow this here and there. I'm Chris Myers. I retired from state service after working 30 years for the people of Oregon back in April 30th, 2005. I worked in the Department of Transportation for 30 years. I held many positions in the agency during that time. I worked in several different places around the state. I started out as a chainman on a survey crew, which is definitely the lowest guy as far as rank goes. But over the career that I had there, I finished out as a senior designer in the roadway section, two blocks away in the highway building. For the first 10 years with the department, I worked on field crews and performed various duties relating to surveying, construction inspection, and location design. The last 20 years with the agency were spent in various roles in design. I also spent several years working as a liaison between the Salem design units and Portland design units for ODOT and TriMet during the design and construction of the West Side Light Rail. I also spent several years doing day-to-day handling of consultant contracts, and I spent the last couple of years working with our roadside safety engineer developing a database covering all the guardrail and barrier systems on all state highways. Now, one thing I really enjoyed in my career with the department was the opportunity to provide service to the people of Oregon. Now, I worked with hundreds of people in the agency who were thinking just like me. I made a long-term commitment to provide service to the people of Oregon and did my best to ensure that the projects I was working on and the work I was assigned were done with the best interest of the taxpayer in mind. Now I'm going to focus on the work I did while handling the day-to-day activity surrounding flexible service contracts, as they were known in the roadway engineering section. During those years, I had the responsibility of dealing with in excess of $50 million in value of consultant contracts. Now, these contracts were with several firms, large firms you've probably heard of, like CH2M Hill and OTAC and DEA, WH Pacific, etc., and many others as well. My duties in this piece of my career were helping to prepare the request for proposals, reviewing and scoring the proposals that came in from the consulting firms, and then interviewing the short list, the consultants who were selected for possibility of getting one of the contracts, and finally negotiating the terms of the contracts, which were known as agreements to agree, or ATAs. And negotiating is probably not the right word to use, because many times we were told that we had to simply accept the rates presented by the consultants. After the contracts were let, of course, my job then was to work with others in preparation of the work orders under these agreements to agree, and handling the reviews of the work that was produced by the consultants, and processing the invoices that were sent in for payment. Now, the thing that really sticks with me about all these contracts I dealt with is the rates that were agreed upon to be paid to the consultants, and that they were far in excess of the costs associated with doing the work with ODOT staff internally. The rates charged by the consultants invariably started out with higher base salary rates. For instance, an engineer who was being paid at the rate of $25 an hour within ODOT, their equivalent in the consulting world was generally paid between $30 and $33 an hour. And that's just the base salary. Now, the overhead rates, of course, every business has an overhead, including ODOT. But the overhead rates that were being charged by the consultants were almost always far in excess of the overhead rate that ODOT put on top of the salaries to pay for, you know, insurance benefits, sick leave days, holidays, keeping the lights on in the buildings, et cetera. And some contracts that I had to deal with, we were charged an additional $1.25 an hour for what was termed communication fees above and beyond the overhead rates that the consultants were charging. And that one never made sense to me. I figured part of their overhead should be the fact that they've got telephones, computers, email systems. But basically I was told to sit down, shut up, do my job. And of course, on top of all this, the contractors, the consulting firms, were granted a percentage for profit. I understand business is in business to make money. And this profit was called just that in the contracts. Now, the thing to remember, though, is that ODOT still had to provide staff to review the work produced by the consultants and to handle the day-to-day paperwork, such as what I was doing. So there's an additional cost that wasn't recognized usually in the cost of the contracts up front. Now, many of the consultant staff members that I dealt with and that were assigned to perform the work under these various work orders were themselves one-time employees of the Department of Transportation. When the PRS reform legislation was passed, a huge number of ODOT engineering and technical staff left the agency, including all but one of the bridge engineering managers. That really was a major problem for ODOT. When I would go to visit one of the consulting firm's offices, it felt like I was walking back into an ODOT office. I would know at least half of the people in the room as I would walk through. I'd be saying hello to people that I used to work beside. Now, I don't blame these people for leaving. They walked out the door getting at least a 20% increase in pay, and they received similar benefit packages. They had good insurance, family coverage insurance fully paid. They had a retirement package. They also received things that state employees don't, but bonuses. Now, these people, of course, knew that they were going out there to do the same work for more money. Now, I myself was approached many times by representatives of these firms with inquiries, hey, do you want to come to work for us? We think you could really fit in well over here. A lot of times these offers were very flattering, and it was very interesting, but I did turn them all down. My commitment was to serve the people of Oregon. I could have left the agency many years before I finally retired, but my choice was to stay and stick out in the commitment that I'd made. And my experience in working with these flexible service contracts is the biggest reason I came to see you guys today. I feel that transparency in government is lacking, and this proposed bill will shine some much-needed light on the contracting processes and the huge dollar amounts that are spent each year by public agencies. And I'm not just narrowing in on ODOT. I can only speak, though, from my experiences there. The information that this bill will make available will clearly show the cost to the taxpayers of all the goods and services that are procured. The information will show the taxpayers which firms are providing good service for the money and which are not. This could be an incentive for those firms doing really good work to keep up that good work. And it could also be an incentive for those who are not performing nearly as well, and there are plenty of those, that perhaps it's time for them to pick up the pace, do a better job. And if these poor performers don't improve, information in this database could be referred to by these agencies in making decisions of whether to go into future contracts with these different firms. Now, the transparency provided in this bill will provide the public, the agencies, and the legislature with the information needed to make good decisions about which work to contract out. I also provided you with a very short spreadsheet showing a half a dozen construction projects that have been let by ODOT in the last few years. Now, this information is already available to you, at members of the legislature, but maybe you don't know where to get it or who to ask for it. This short list is clear evidence to me that there's a need for a database as proposed in this bill. The first five projects on this list show that there are increases between $3 million and $68 million, or 23 to 53% from the original bid amounts that the contractors put up to secure the contracts. Now, these increases come as a result of contract change orders and contractor claims, for the most part. There are other factors, but those are the two big ones that I know about. And these change orders and claims, in many cases, are clearly the result of poor construction plans and poor project special provisions that are put together by, whether it's inside ODOT or through a consulting firm's efforts. Now, the last project on the list, it does show that there was an underrun, but the problem there is that you can see that that was a contract that was terminated only partway through construction. The contractor's already been paid over $650,000, and that the work is not complete. Now somebody else is going to have to come in and fix that. I don't know whether that's going to be state services to finish this small project. By small, I mean it was in the range of $1 million. Or whether they're going to, they being ODOT, is going to have to then prepare new plans and specifications and hire a different company to complete that work. Another thing, and I didn't include this in my written document to you, but it struck me as other people were talking this morning, a problem that I faced many times in those years dealing with consulting firms is that after the request for proposals have come in, they've been scored, and we've got a list of several different firms to deal with and to interview. These firms would definitely come to the interviews with their A-team. These would be their sharpest engineers, their best environmental staffers, all their bright, shining stars in their companies. And they would say to us, these are the people that we're going to have do this work for you. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works in the real world. And in some, it was almost spectacular that once the contract was secured, second and third string staff is who was really assigned to do the work, and the product suffered for it. Now I'll get back to my text here. A major problem with outsourcing the work traditionally performed by ODOT staff is that consultants and contractors lack long-term commitment. Like myself, I planned on 30 years or more with ODOT. These people, and don't get me wrong, I understand the profit motive. They're in this to make money, and they're in it to make money as fast as they can. But they don't think about the long-term consequences of poor work, whether it's poor design work or poor construction work. They leave when they're done. My opinion, they know they're not going to be held accountable to fix what's wrong. They know that ODOT's going to be on the hook. And unfortunately, that's exactly how it's gone. So that's the end of it. Thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them right now. And if I don't know the answer, I'll find out the best of my ability and as soon as possible. Also, my email address and phone numbers are on that short list there of contracts.
Thank you, Chris. Questions? And I want to thank you for coming. I don't believe that there are any questions, so thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
I'm going to ask if there's anyone who has any short additions that they'd like to make to the testimony or in the audience right now. And not seeing any, I'm going to close this information meeting. And I'm going to open a work session on LC 1476. This is a bill very similar to one we saw last session, and I want to present that for the committee to create a committee bill for.
You need a motion?
Yes.
Am I recognized?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 1476, dated 10-9-08, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Edwards moves that LC 1476, dated 10-9-08, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, I read the bill and was rereading it and focusing on parts of it now, and I think that I, of all people, support transparency. And I believe that's very important. I think that a number of the provisions of this bill are very burdensome, and I can't figure out why they would be of value to place on the agencies to have to go into great detail as to, for instance, contracts that were, the bidding process was let, but there wasn't a selection process. Well, if there's a decision not to go forward, to have to require that there be detailed explanation as to why it wasn't gone forward, number of protests, how protests were resolved, and all of those things is burdensome. I think that to not require or to require that there be monthly or hourly tracking of all work that's done by contractors and subcontractors and their employees, as an employer myself, it's very difficult to do that. It's burdensome to do that. Now, if the contract requires or is going to be paid on the basis of an hourly rate, that's certainly appropriate. If it's a performance-based contract, then to do that is merely to add a very a substantial burden on contracting employers to have to do that. I think that it's obvious to me that there's major concerns about the number of contracts that are being let out that previously may have been done by government entity. There's this pendulum that switch goes back and forth. I mean, the reason that ODOT, that we several terms ago, sessions ago, went and emphasized the need for consulting was the idea that there was 900 and some engineers with ODOT, and it was much greater for the size of our state than other states, and there's a tremendous cost because each position is an annual cost, whether the contracts are there's contracts being worked on or not. And the idea was that when you have a bridge project, then why not contract out with consultants, design the bridge project, and then be done with it, but not have to have people on staff when there may be no bridge project pending. The challenge, of course, as we look back on it, is that there were a number of people who left ODOT and became the consultants, and so you had essentially in many instances the same engineers that were working for ODOT now becoming the consultants, and there was no real savings that I've been able to see as a result. And so the move, okay, maybe we need to move this pendulum back, and I just would love if we could come to a rational approach where things kind of go to the middle and not over a period of 5 to 10 years go back and forth. Anyway, I think that as the bill is currently written, I'm not able to support it.
Okay. First of all, supporting moving this forward is not you know, necessarily an endorsement of the bill. We'll be having the opportunity for amendments, as you know, and we'll have a vote on whether we actually like the bill during session. But let me explain one of the reasons why I think this is an important bill. I asked for a report last session on contracts, and I stuck to kind of contracts that I knew most about, which is IT contracts. And what I discovered was they weren't able to give me that report for any contracts other than personnel replacement contracts. And the reason they could do that is because they knew how many hours at what cost those contractors were performing under a contract, and they knew what it would cost for the department to do it internally. So I was able to get a report which said, oh, now we know whether it is better for us to do it in-house or to let contracts. We haven't made any progress on doing something about it yet, but we found out that in many, many instances, we would save significant money by bringing those contracts back in-house. And you're aware of that. But I wasn't able to determine on these other contracts where we had no information about how many hours were spent on it by what kind of employees. We didn't know. So how do we determine whether or not this is something that we can bring in-house and save money? I couldn't find a way to do that. So that's part of my motivation is to shed some light on what the actual cost of doing a contract is. And we don't know. We don't know because we don't know how much of that is a cost and how much of it is profit. And there's a difference.
Mr. Chair, if you're saying that we will, that it really is about transparency, and that if there can be shown that there's provisions that are overly burdensome and not really beneficial toward that goal, then I would have no objection.
That's my goal. And we will have the opportunity, obviously, for amendments and to discuss. And I'd like to sit down with you and discuss those. Any further discussion? Representative Byer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm supporting introduction of this bill. I mean, I think it's just kind of a courtesy thing anyway. It doesn't obligate you to anything. But I'm looking forward to the discussion in session. I think what we've discovered is that this is certainly not a one-size-fits-all type of a process. We can't, I mean, right. You know, there are so many different contracts and things out there that it should be a very lively discussion. But I do believe that we're accountable for the taxpayers' dollars, and if we're handing those out to people, there should be some transparency there that we can actually look at and say, you know, this is what we're doing with your money. And so this is the goal I'm looking for as we move down this road.
And I believe that we may be able to carve out some exceptions where it's clear that there is no way that the state could do the contract that we're letting, even if we could hire the people. I mean, there are those exceptions, and we all know there are those exceptions. So I think that we need to look very closely at how this goes forward. But this is as you know, the bill writing process is long and tedious, and this is a first step. So,
a brief comment.
Representative Richardson touched a little bit on how burdensome it could be. I don't know how burdensome it will be to contractors to track all this stuff. I do know that there are certainly professions that have that down. I mean, whenever I call our family's attorney, I pick up the phone and I keep the conversations as quick and as short as possible because they've got that down. So, I know that there are certainly professions that know how to bill down to the
I guarantee you that every company that's doing a good job knows how many hours their employees are working and how much they're paying them. So, with any further discussion, are there objections to moving this forward as a committee bill? Then that will be what we'll do. We'll move it forward as a committee bill. Thank you very much, and that ends the meeting for today. Thank you all for your testimony.